The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. If you were watching over the weekend, it was hard to tell if it was a vigil or a rally, a political rally for the auto industry. Were they trying to survive or were they begging for money? It was very, very difficult to tell.
I think it's critical that we move fast, not only critical for the auto sector, but I think for a lot of other sectors as well.
The auto industry is the backbone of American manufacturing and a critical part of our attempt to reduce our dependence on foreign oil.
In the time between now and Inauguration Day, issues are crowding to the front for Barack Obama, the president-elect, to deal with. There he's referring to the auto crisis that's taken place since Election Day. And joining us now to discuss it is Micheline Maynard, Detroit-based New York Times business correspondent, on the phone from Detroit. Micheline, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure, John.
And also in the studio is our friend Alvin Hall, financial consultant and author. His latest book is Show Me the Money. Alvin, thanks so much for coming in.
Glad to be here, John.
Mickey, what I want to begin talking with you about is, since the election, it appears as though all sense of security in the auto industry is sort of off. I mean, they've revealed, all right, now that the election is over, you need to save us or we're going to go away. What's your assessment as to how much consolidation is likely here, regardless of the level of the bailout? Are we going to lose one or two companies here?
Well, we very well could lose one company. I don't think we'll lose two companies. And when I say lose one company, I think what could end up happening with Chrysler is it could be sold off in pieces. I think parts of it will survive and parts of it will be sold off, and some parts of it might disappear. And I don't think anybody should think that the American automobile industry is going to disappear overnight. Don't forget that Detroit now has less than half of the market share of the auto industry, and the rest of it is divided between companies like Toyota, Honda, BMW, and the others. So people will be able to buy cars. It's not going to be a problem. There'll be Americans building cars in America. They might not just do it for Detroit car companies.
No, and you're referring to the factories of Honda and Toyota and other Japanese manufacturers, even German manufacturers in the United States who are building cars successfully. How many jobs are at stake here, and how much of the negotiations over a bailout involve the union negotiating over specific issues of pension, et cetera?
Right. Well, let me give you a little bit of context. In 1979, when we had the Chrysler bailout, there were about 1 million people in the United States building cars for the Detroit automakers. Now we're down to about 200,000 people. That's still a lot of people, and there's about one job in Detroit will affect 7 more jobs in the economy. So you have suppliers, you have dealers, you have people who work in coal mines who provide coal that fires plants that make steel, et cetera. So there's a big spillover effect. It's probably a bigger spillover effect than there actually are jobs in Detroit.
1.4 million to 2 million is what you say are threatened if all of the jobs in Detroit were to go away. Is that roughly
right,
the calculation? All right. So how does the union figure into these negotiations here, and how do issues like pension and health care figure as part of the dollar amount that the government is going to be asked to pay here?
Well, it's kind of a three-legged stool. First of all, there are UAW-represented jobs. Second, there are pensions that were negotiated by the UAW for its members, which is there's actually far more retirees now in the UAW than there are active members. And those pensions would be taken on by the PBGC, the Federal Pension Board, and people get about 30 cents on the dollar for every dollar in pension they're supposed to get if a company goes bankrupt. So the federal pension system would have to shoulder that. And then the third issue here is something that's a little bit murky. And what happened a year ago when the UAW negotiated new contracts with the Detroit car companies was the creation of what's called a VEBA. And these are special health care funds that would have shouldered the Detroit company's responsibility for their health care costs for retirees. And that liability is about $100 billion. And those funds had to be funded up front in cash. And in return, the UAW was going to become the largest shareholder in General Motors and Ford. So what's being proposed now, and this is why you hear such a large number, $50 billion, is the proposal is that the federal government instead fund those health care funds. In other words, the federal government would be paying for essentially health care for UAW retirees.
So it's bailing the UAW out of its now pretty dubious stock position in GM and providing value through the taxpayers.
Yeah, essentially they would put up the money instead of the car makers, allowing the car makers to use that money to fund their operations and their product programs.
Mickey, let's talk about the politics of this. The Bush administration has signaled its resistance to throwing in an extra $50 billion. But clearly you heard that statement from President-elect Obama indicating that the car manufacturing industry is critical. How do you think this request is being considered now, and what are we likely to see in the next 60 days as President Bush, towards the end of the year, as President Bush heads to the end of his administration?
Right. The Bush administration basically told the car makers about a week ago that they wouldn't let them tap into the banking bailout to pay for the things that they're proposing. What they've since come back with to the future Obama administration is this idea of funding the VEBA and a couple of other sort of bailout ways that are separate from that main banking bailout bill. And I think that that's gotten a receptive ear among Democrats. I think they understand that union support was very important in getting President-elect Obama the victory. And I think the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, is sympathetic to the car companies. And so they'll get a warmer reception, I think, in the new administration.
Well, how quickly this will transpire before there's another quarterly report out of the auto industry. It'd be hard to imagine something worse than last time. But, they're burning money at $1 billion a month or something like that, $2 billion a month. Mickey Maynard, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mickey Maynard is Detroit-based New York Times business correspondent speaking to us from Detroit. I mean, listen to that, Alvin. I mean, you've got pensions at risk. You've also got jobs at risk. I mean, you can't get more Main Street than that.
Exactly. And this is one of the things that Obama must focus on, because in order for people to feel that their confidence and hope in him is realized, he has to start working on Main Street as soon as he walks through the door. At the same time, he needs to focus on the auto industry. She said that it was approximately 1 in 7 jobs. I've read also that 1 in 10 jobs in America is dependent upon the auto industry. So he must focus on that immediately.
Well, if you're in that 1 in 10 group and maybe don't even know you're in that 1 in 10
group,
how should you feel this morning?
You're going to feel nervous, actually, because the bad thing is it's sort of like having this cloud over your head, sort of like Peanuts and Linus, right? This cloud of unemployment, this cloud of uncertainty. And so what you're thinking of is, how am I going to survive? What do I need to do to make sure that I can get through this crisis as an employed person, or hold on to enough money so that I can support myself?
And the stakes are incredibly high. We're talking about potentially as many as 3 million jobs at stake if you consider who survives and who doesn't in the auto industry.
Yes.
So in moving forward, obviously that's a serious balancing act in saving the industry or figuring out a policy to address the ills of the industry.
Yes.
That's a heavy weight.
It is a heavy weight. And this morning, on my way into the studio, I kept thinking of, what would they be doing in Europe in this case? If we have to put all of this money into this industry, what would they be doing in Europe? And they would probably ask for a percentage of ownership of the company, so that if the companies then came back around, then the government would somehow benefit. So you would essentially make these organizations partly owned by the government. If this were European, that would be very controversial.
But UAW did that in their latest sort of healthcare
thing,
and now they're trying to unload the stock because it's almost worthless. You know, let's remind people, or it's gone down so much. I mean, that value
it's
has gone down significantly. Let's remind people of how broad the scope is here in terms of the jobs affected. I mean, you not only have Mickey Maynard talked about someone who's maybe a coal miner, who sends coal to the steel industry, of course, which supplies the auto industry. That's easy to see.
Yes.
But it's also true that, like, an associate producer at a network program, the revenues from car ads are down, and yes. ad companies, you know, creative directors, those kinds of people are also threatened.
Exactly. And you also have all the people who create the new products in for cars, you know, things.
Designers,
exactly. Plastic makers, leather makers, lawyers involved. People forget that this is a huge industry with a huge knock-on effect. And most of us go through our daily lives not realizing that some aspect of our life is actually influenced by the car industry. I see a frown on Adora's face over there.
No, I mean, it's humbling, the enormity of it.
Is Adora's job threatened by the auto industry? No,
I don't think so.
That'd be good. Well, we'll talk about that when we come back. Alvin Hall is with us. His latest book is Show Me the Money. He's with us all hour talking about the Main Street implications of a very dire global economic crisis that Barack Obama is dealing with on day one, even day one minus 70 days as he thinks about what the priorities are going to be in his new administration.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. As is becoming clear, Barack Obama will have plenty on his plate on January 20th. But we want you to give us some suggestions of things to put on his night table between now and then, books and movies, suggestions for Barack Obama to take up on his to-do list as he prepares for inauguration.
Hi, my name is Richard Cavish. I live in Nyack, New York. The book I'd recommend that him read would be The Sonnets of William Shakespeare. They are perfect in every way. They're only 14 lines long each. They prove that good things can come in small packages, and that if you don't waste any words at all, you can still achieve a perfect work of art.
Call us at 877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org for your suggestion. You don't have to have them rhyme.
But it's nice if you do. We appreciate that. And we were just talking about the auto industry. As we watch the auto industry hemorrhage money and jobs, what does the employment landscape look like, not only in the auto industry, but across the country? Joining us is financial consultant Alvin Hall and also the author of Show Me the Money. So we were just talking about how the auto industry and them having to slash jobs and reconfigure in the face of many challenges really truly affects Americans in ways that are unexpected.
Yes, because people will feel that their jobs are threatened, whether you're working in advertising or the company that makes the leather for the auto industry or the company that makes the little plastic things and mold them for the auto industry. All of those jobs will be threatened, and people will start to cut back on spending. We're entering the Christmas holiday season. As we enter that season, people are not going to want to walk past these windows and put money down in the stores. So stores will hire fewer part-time workers over the holiday season. How many people, and I know quite a few, depend upon that part-time job to pay for their gifts during Christmas? You watch holiday sales begin to contract. Then stores will start to lay off more people. It's a domino effect that's going through the economy.
We could even lose some stores as a result.
People oh, absolutely. You walk through any
chains.
Store in Manhattan. Yeah. Right now, and it's some of them, you could bowl down the main alley because there are no people. There's just not enough people to sustain the stores. It's frightening.
But let's make a distinction, yes. Something that John pointed out earlier today, before we started the show, actually, he and I were having a conversation, but that those jobs in stores are likely to come back when the economy bounces back, as we all expect
yes.
it will. Those jobs in the auto industry, though, there are a significant portion of them that are just never going to come back.
Never at all, because the training that the people have or the skills are so specific to that industry, they have no elasticity in them. So this is another area that the government has to focus on, very much the way they did it in FDR days. They're going to have to provide some way to retrain these people or to give them other jobs in which those skills are useful.
But that was a manufacturing time in the 1930s, and now it seems like since the 70s, which is what this recession seems to smell most like, although the numbers aren't in yet, based on contemporary history. You know, we've become a service economy since the 1970s. How does that affect the transition, particularly if you're in one of these jobs where you're really concerned?
I think it's going to make the transition very hard for people who are in traditional manufacturing jobs. The service economy requires a different set of skills than just going in and using a wrench and putting a car together or making something like that. You have to have a different set of language skills. You have to have a different set of people skills. I think it seems easy on the surface, but if you've never had to do that kind of job in a service economy where you're dealing with people, it can be hard to do. I think the training is the important part. I think if the government or states put into place a training program that will help people with the skills, they might develop them. But I think it's going to be hard for them.
But how do states do that when one of the side effects of this troubled automotive industry is a lack of tens of millions of dollars that are going into the coffers of local and state governments who would be in a position to set up these programs and help workers transition?
They don't have the money. The government, I think the government is going to eventually, I hate to say this, they're going to have to print more money in order to make this happen. States don't have the money. School systems don't have the money. So you're watching as the whole job market just contracts around us.
So if you produce ink, actually, you're in good shape. Because the printing of the
red
money.
Ink.
Yeah, red
ink.
Yeah, right. Red ink and green ink for printing the money. Well, let's talk about healthcare. There's a growth industry. There's an industry that supposedly does really well in bad times. What are the opportunities for people in the troubled service sector or troubled manufacturing sector to get into healthcare? Obviously, they're not going to become doctors and nurses, but there are other ways of getting in.
Yeah, you can go and get the training to become a home care assistant. You can work as a sort of nurse or a low-level assistant in a hospital. But will those people find those jobs as satisfying? Or will they take those jobs just because we need to earn money?
The pay is lower,
and the hours are often much longer, and the jobs involve dealing with people who are not necessarily in the best health or best situation. And a lot of people find that very difficult.
And doesn't that depend a lot on where you live in the country?
Yes.
Because healthcare opportunities, lay that out for us, they're readily available in some regions of the country as opposed to others.
Exactly. You look in cities, you'll find more hospitals. You look in areas like North Carolina, where you have the Research Triangle Park, where there's a lot of work going on there. Other places like that around the country where people can get jobs in those sectors. But if you're living in Iowa, perhaps, or maybe even around Detroit, where there isn't that much of this type of work, it's hard. It's hard. This, you know, I think this discussion is so important because what we're showing is that Barack Obama is coming into the Oval Office with a tidal wave of problems. Mm. And between now and the time that he comes in, he and his economic advisors have to sit down and really come up with some unusual or new solutions to these problems. I think he's doing the right thing in bringing in all these different points of view at this time, but they're going to have to be very creative because everywhere you look, there's no good news.
Thanks for that, Alvin Hall. We're gonna leave it at that. Leave Alvin Hall, financial consultant, author of Show Me the Money. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got some headlines for us.
I'm trying to prove Alvin wrong, but not on this newscast. Good morning. It's 28 minutes past the hour. The federal government is upping its aid to insurance giant AIG. The new plan will increase the company's loan to $150 billion. It may also lower the interest rate for loan paybacks. The money comes from the $700 billion set aside for financial bailouts. Stock markets across Asia rose sharply today following China's announcement yesterday of a large economic stimulus plan. The country promised $586 billion to encourage economic growth. Barack Obama is planning to reverse a number of President Bush's more controversial policies. That's according to John Podesta, a top member of his transition team. Here, challenge decisions that restrict stem cell research and allow oil drilling in the wilderness. And meanwhile, the two men will meet in person today at the White House. That's President Bush and President-elect Obama. The historic visit is coming earlier than usual because of the severity of the financial crisis. And despite their policy differences, Mr. Obama says he expects the meeting to be genial. And keep your headphones away from your pacemaker or your defibrillator. And that's the advice from the American Heart Association. They tested 8 brands of MP3 headphones on patients and found that 20% of them cause problems. It's the magnets in the headphones that if you keep next to your pacemaker, you may well find yourself getting an irregular heartbeat. Also, don't hug people if you've got your iPhone on.
Pacemaker News there from Femi. Okay, thank
you're
you.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Everyone's trying to get Barack Obama's attention. Why shouldn't you?
This is Jerry McCaffrey from New York City. I'd suggest that he get himself a copy of Groundhog Day, the movie, and watch it. One, it's very funny. Two, it's about transformation, which is what he wants to do. And three, hopefully, it's about not repeating the mistakes we've gone through for the last 8 years.
Tell us your suggestions for President-elect Barack Obama's to-do list. What should he read, watch, or listen to, and why? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Well, Groundhog is certainly a vision there, but today in Washington will be nothing like Groundhog Day. President-elect Barack Obama will meet with President Bush for a tour of the White House. That's common, but it's very early this time around. Obama's transition, well, they are well underway. And to that, to talk about that and today's meeting, Cheryl Gay Stolberg joins us. She covers the White House for the New York Times. Good morning and welcome, Cheryl.
Good morning.
It seems like this is going to be a presidential transition like no other, beginning with today's meeting, which usually doesn't happen until much later.
Well, that's right. But I think the urgency of the financial crisis is pushing this meeting forward. Everyone is obviously turned to President-elect Obama and how he will handle the crisis. And I think the Bush White House wanted to send a signal that it's ready to move forward with a dignified and smooth transition. And so we have this very quick invitation.
Cheryl, let's listen quickly to how President Bush described it.
This peaceful transfer of power is one of the hallmarks of a true democracy. And ensuring that this transition is as smooth as possible is a priority for the rest of my presidency.
Despite all the rhetoric of the campaign and obviously the way that President-elect Obama criticized the Bush administration, they both really have an interest in making this transition go smoothly, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Of course, President Bush wants to appear gracious. He is, in fact, a gracious person, and I think he really believed what he said in that clip that you played. He wants to have a dignified, orderly transition. He's also an orderly person. He prides himself on being a good manager. You can have a debate about that. And certainly, Senator Obama wants to make clear that the country will be stable as we move into his administration. He wants to not make any quick or unexpected moves. He wants to make sure, especially in time of financial crisis, that we have an easy, orderly path to the next administration.
You've written about how some of these meetings between the current president and the president-elect have been a bit awkward over the years. You want to tell us about some of those?
Yeah, well, it hasn't always gone very well. In 1980, for instance, after Ronald Reagan beat Jimmy Carter, Carter invited Reagan to the White House. And Carter apparently came away from their meeting feeling as though Reagan had not been paying attention. Jody Powell, Carter's former press secretary, told me that there was a point during the meeting where Reagan seemed to sort of wander off and ask questions that were only tangentially related to what the two were talking about. And on top of that, the Carter White House had offered to share information about the Iranian hostage crisis with the incoming Reagan administration. Powell said the Reagan team didn't want it at all. They just wanted the Carter White House to handle it without them being involved enough to have to take responsibility for whatever happened. And then the most recent transition certainly was a bitter one for Vice President Al Gore. And on Inauguration Day, the Clintons invited the Bushes. This is Inauguration Day 2001. The Clintons invited the Bushes in for coffee before the ceremony. And Clinton was apparently his normal, gregarious, outgoing self, but Gore was also there. And according to Ari Fleischer, President Bush's first press secretary, it was a very sour moment for Vice President Gore, and very uncomfortable for him.
Sounds it. It definitely sounds it. Cheryl, behind the scenes, though, as the transition proceeds, there's also a lot of turmoil as policy gets nailed down, maybe in advance of the inauguration. I'm wondering if you have any comment on this AIG story overnight, where apparently $40 billion new dollars are going to go to AIG, an insurance company, at the exact same moment that the auto industry is begging for a similar amount of money, and it's very unclear whether they're going to get it or not.
Well, that could well be a topic of this meeting today. I know that the Democrats have been pressing for help for the auto industry, and I don't believe I've heard President-elect Obama speak to that specifically. He may have, but certainly Nancy Pelosi on the Hill has. And there will be points of tension in this meeting today because President Bush and Barack Obama have extremely different worldviews. Let's face it, that's why Barack Obama got elected. So on the economy, on the need for a stimulus package, on the use of bailout money, these things may come up. Now, Obama has said we only have one president at a time, and he respects, of course, President Bush's right to exercise policy decisions as he sees fit for the next 70-some-odd days or so. But, you know, obviously things are going to change on January 20th.
Cheryl, very last question. What are you particularly going to be looking to hear after these two meet today?
You know, I think that it won't be a surprise what we hear. We'll hear that they're going to work together, that they are committed to an orderly transition, all that sort of thing. I guess I'll be interested to see in particular how President-elect Obama approaches this upcoming international economic summit, because the President Bush has invited 20 world leaders in on Saturday. The Bush administration could very well take steps with international leaders that could box in the Obama administration. The Obama team won't want that, so I'll be looking for any nuances or perhaps slight divisions there. And I'll also look at their body language, just how they seem together as people.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg, thank you for joining us this morning.
Okay, thank you.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg is a New York Times correspondent, and she covers the White House
and Barack
out
Obama
of D.C.
Certainly has some complex body language. Watchers of The View understand that. there may be something to watch there. I think the only real awkwardness, though, is if Barack Obama actually brings the new puppy over to try out on the White House lawn.
Right.
That could be awkward.
Yes.
Yeah.
But
probably not going to happen.
We're going to do some headlines, though, now. From Femi Okay.
Hello there. The time is 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Police report that at least 28 people are dead and dozens more injured after two bombs went off this morning in northern Baghdad. As people hurried to help victims of a car bombing, a suicide bomber ran into the crowd and blew himself up. According to a report by the New York Times, the U.S. military has carried out almost a dozen secret attacks against al-Qaeda in Pakistan, Syria, and elsewhere. The raids were authorized in 2004 by a secret order, allowing the military to attack al-Qaeda anywhere in the world. The Defense Department has not confirmed the report. Cholera is beginning to spread among refugees in eastern Congo. 45 cases have been reported in the region since Friday, and nearly a quarter of a million people were displaced in fighting between rebel forces and government troops. Meanwhile, the UN reports that new fighting has erupted in the eastern part of the Congo. The search for survivors continues after a school collapsed Friday in Haiti. Firefighters have been using sonar and also rescue dogs to search the wreckage of the building. The accident has left 90 people dead.
Horrible story. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. Joining us now is Daniel Schaefer, Frankfurt correspondent of the Financial Times, to talk about a story which I think is emblematic of the insanity in the global finance market and the global auto market. What do they say? Invest in companies you know about. The Porsche company, in trying to secretly take over Volkswagen, certainly proved that that is true. They invested in Volkswagen, and for a moment, the strange, bizarre investment vehicles that they used to try to acquire Volkswagen produced a bulge in the German markets that was absolutely unprecedented, and we're still feeling waves of. Daniel Schaefer, can you possibly explain what happened between Porsche and Volkswagen?
Yeah, I can. Porsche, basically what Porsche did is they used some options which are banned in other countries and but still allowed in Germany to secretly acquire a stake. And what happened last week was that they revealed they had secretly acquired about 75% of Volkswagen shares. And that left some investors who actually bet on a decline of Volkswagen shares struggling to cover their positions, but there wasn't hardly any free float left of VW shares.
So the VW stock went way through the roof, and the sales of Porsche and VW are down, on the books it looks like they're doing fantastically well.
Yeah, it actually helped them to make a huge profit that is even bigger than their revenues. So there is many people who now dub Porsche as being a hedge fund rather than a car maker, because they've made 8 times more money by actually those option trades than they did with actually selling cars.
And the characters at Porsche who engineered this are, you know, they're kind of Einstein types, aren't they?
Yeah, they're really clever, and some say, they're much cleverer than some of the investment bankers, because they use methods there which resemble some tactics.
Well, hey, they build Porsches.
Investment bankers.
They build they build Porsches. Of course, they're smart.
Yeah, they have. These are great cars. So, but it's not really. I mean, engineer-driven company that they kind of manage to outsmart financial investors. That's really a thing you don't find very often.
Now, is that the lesson here? Is that sort of the takeaway from what happened in Germany? That the message for the car companies: get out of making cars, get into bizarre investments.
I don't think it would be a good long-term strategy, and it won't help Porsche in the future neither. I mean, they've made really good money now with these deals, but they won't in the future, because this can't go on forever. And actually, everybody now thinks that in the next year, they will have a huge drop in their profits because all those trade gains will vanish. They won't be there anymore, and then they will be in the same problems. We'll have to face the same problems as the entire car industry, which is a massive demand slump and less people willing to buy, especially the more expensive cars.
Well, Daniel, so it's a great point you make. Lightning probably doesn't strike twice in the same place, and this is more like a defibrillator. The dead body is sort of flopping around. It doesn't mean good news for the car industry. Daniel Schaefer, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Daniel Schaefer is Frankfurt correspondent of the Financial Times, talking about Porsche's takeover of Volkswagen and what it means for the global auto industry.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, November 10th. Femi Okeh has just joined us with the latest headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President-elect Barack Obama doesn't officially take the White House until January, but he'll be there today in his first post-election visit. He'll meet with the current occupant to talk transition and get a briefing on problems he'll face once he takes office. Laura Bush and Michelle Obama will also have their own private meeting. Over in the House, several tight House races now have winners. Looking at the big picture, the Democrats will have a net gain of 19 House seats. 4 other House races are still too close to call. The Dems gained 6 new seats in the Senate so far, where 3 races are undecided. It's a strong day so far for European markets. Indices across the continent are up, and this after Asian markets closed higher following news of China's more than $500 billion stimulus package. A new deal will bring full-length MDM movies to YouTube. The studio will allow the free video site to stream certain movies. They will make more money selling ads on the videos. And the move is a bid to compete with Hulu, which already streams full movies and TV episodes from NBC News and News Corp's library. And finally, there's a lot of Miriam Makeba around today. Oh. The South African singer died earlier this morning. It's a great excuse to play some of her greatest hits. Have a listen to this one. This is Pata Pata. Now, Pata Pata is a dance in Johannesburg, and what Miriam Makeba is singing about is that once this music starts to play, everybody starts swinging and dancing and swaying, and you dance all night long. It was one of her big hits here in the States. Miriam Makeba was banned for 30 years from South Africa. She went to the Venice Film Festival to pick up an award and wasn't let back into her own country for 30 years. She went back in the 1990s. And she continued to actually tour because she didn't make any money from all of the times that she sang in the 50s and 60s. Very badly invested, and she actually was just touring the day that she died. Miriam Makeba died at the age of 76.
She was an extraordinary performer. I went to several of her concerts, and they were always packed. The woman was magic on the stage.
And known as Mama Africa.
Mama Africa.
Yeah.
Turn now to politics, where Senate Democrats, well, they have a conundrum on their hands. Democratic-turned-independent Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman, he actively campaigned for Republican John McCain and accused President-elect Obama of not putting the country first and voting to cut off funding for U.S. troops on the ground. Some Democrats want him punished, at the very least, by being relieved of his chairmanship of the Senate Homeland Security Committee. But Majority Leader Harry Reid says he's trying to keep Lieberman with the Democratic caucus. Joining us for more is John Dankosky, who is the news director of WNPR in Hartford, and he's been following Senator Lieberman's career for many years. Good morning and welcome, John.
Hi, thanks.
So Senator Lieberman certainly leveled some harsh criticism against Barack Obama and Democrats in general. Why does he think he should retain his status as chairman of Homeland Security?
Well, Joe Lieberman has been someone who's put himself in the middle of American politics for such a long time. He sees himself as a centrist. He has often said that his support for John McCain was really support for the man, John McCain, and really shouldn't be seen as anything that was negative about Barack Obama. Of course, some of his words didn't exactly back that up. Security, Homeland Security, has really been his number one issue since 9/11, and I think that's one of the main reasons he has said he wants to stay in the middle of things in Washington. He thinks he can be a sort of nonpartisan voice and someone who has a good track record in national security, who can be somebody who can serve both the Democrats and the Republicans.
Nonpartisan voice is probably something some Democratic senators would certainly take issue to. Let's listen to the heart of the issue here, which is some words of Senator Lieberman in 2006 and then some words in a speech he gave at the Republican National Convention.
The gifts that God has given to Barack Obama are as enormous as his future is unlimited. As his mentor, as his colleague, as his friend, I look forward to helping him reach to the stars. In the Senate, during the 3.5 years that Senator Obama has been a member, he has not reached across party lines to accomplish anything significant, nor has he been willing to take on powerful interest groups in the Democratic Party to get something done.
Yeah, with mentors like that, who needs, you know, what are they saying?
I mean, but that's the heart of it, how to reconcile those two sides of Senator Lieberman.
Well, and of course, those two sides of Senator Lieberman are the sort of things that we've seen on display for just a number of years here. Look, I want to take you back to 2000, when he was first picked to be vice president by Al Gore. Look, at the time, I was there when he first introduced himself to the Connecticut press as the new vice presidential nominee. People were ecstatic about Joe. People in the Democratic Party were ecstatic about Joe because of the sort of thing that you just heard there. He's able to speak from a place of real depth and feeling about people in the Democratic Party who he loves. Like, he spoke about Barack Obama there. He rallied the troops. He raised millions of dollars in Connecticut alone for that race. And a lot of people at the time loved Joe. And it seems, honestly, it's just been a downhill glide ever since as far as his popularity, both amongst party insiders in the state and also amongst people of the state of Connecticut.
And how do they describe what you're saying is clearly disappointment?
Well, a most recent poll, this is from the University of Connecticut and the Hartford Courant, it has Joe Lieberman's approval ratings at somewhere around 41%. That's by far the lowest he's ever been at in his career. 58% of the people in this poll said he's guided by, quote, his own political ambitions. 34% say he acts in the interests of voters, which means most of the voters of Connecticut think that Joe Lieberman is out for Joe Lieberman. If you go through the course of time, back in 2000, he was running for vice president, but he decided to run also for his Senate seat. If he had won the vice presidency and his Senate seat could have been filled by a Republican nominee by our governor. Then later on, he spent quite a bit of time running for president himself back in 2004, unsuccessfully. He spent an awful lot of time, certainly recently, running for John McCain. But this all goes back, guys, I think, to 2006, where it really started to collapse for Joe Lieberman's popularity. He got taken on by an upstart candidate and lost in the Democratic primary and then decided to run as an independent. I think a lot of times Joe Lieberman since then has said, this has freed me up. Now I'm an independent. I'm an independent voice, and I can sort of do whatever I want. And now I think it's all come home to roost.
Well, what you're describing is the Connecticut electorate seems to be fed up on some level with Joe Lieberman and with Chris Dodd as a rising star now in the majority in the Senate. I mean, the huge power that he's going to have. It's unclear as to where the electorate is going to necessarily, be insulted or be concerned about Joe Lieberman's fortunes at this point. There's a policy consideration, though, on the Homeland Security Committee. I wonder if you could sort this out. It seems to me that with Joe Lieberman so much in support of the Patriot Act and a lot of the Bush policies on Homeland Security, that the Barack Obama administration is going to definitely want someone different at the helm of that committee if they are going to shift gears at all.
Well, I think that that's one of the things that people in Connecticut who are viewing this through, I guess, a bit of anger at a man that they're calling Traitor Joe, they're really looking at. At the end of the day, if Joe Lieberman leaves this very powerful committee, it probably won't be just as a method of punishment, because I would guess that the new Obama administration doesn't want to get off to a start of bipartisanship by kicking people out just for insubordination. As you say, John, I think it very well may come down to the fact that the Barack Obama administration wants to part ways with anybody who had anything to do with the Iraq War or anything having to do with the Patriot Act or some of the policies of the Bush administration post 9/11.
And quickly, on the flip side of that, what bargaining position is Senator Lieberman in if he's not popular at home, he's not popular in his Democratic caucus in the Senate? Where does he get any negotiating power from?
Well, at the end of the day, it's the same place that he says he was beforehand, the same place that people like John McCain and Olympia Snow are in the Senate. People who can reach across party lines, sort of a big middle for the Senate. And that's something that I think he'll continue to say that he can play a role in. And it just remains to be seen whether or not he'll be able to.
Thank you very much. John Dankosky, news director and host of Where We Live, WNPR in Hartford.
Is it a big middle or is it a big muddy at this point for Joe Lieberman? That's really the question.
I don't know. It's a fascinating political question. The dynamic is I can't recall a senator who's sort of outside and inside one of the party systems.
Chilly. Well, we are still on at the Takeaway. In his next 71 days until his inauguration, we are stacking books, movies, music, and other suggestions, not on Joe Lieberman's night table, on Barack Obama's night table.
Chris Krieger, calling from Stillwater, Oklahoma. I think Obama could do great to read Paul Harrison's The Greening of Africa. It's a great book on how to really do development aid programs at home and abroad.
877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're talking about the economy. We're talking about the financial bailout in China and in the United States and with the auto industry. And if you missed anything, where are we?
We are on iTunes. You can check out our podcast with everything you missed today. I'm Adora Udoji.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And
planned by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
China to spend more than a half a trillion to save the world. Oh, it's definitely a revolution.
Everyone's carrying pictures of Hu Jintao. China's bailing out the global economy anyhow. Haven't you heard we're gonna be all right? Banker's gonna be all right. Yellow dog capitalist's gonna be all right.
We're all right. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, November 10th. And wait a second. Was that you singing?
That was John Lennon.
Oh, that was...
Yeah, it's a little-known recording, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good morning, Adora.
I don't believe you. Good morning, everyone. Today, Russia's latest move on the international scene, the global food crisis, and the Poker World Series playing this year for $32 million of a purse. Those stories coming up first, some headlines.
No recession in poker. Barack Obama will be in the White House today, not as president just yet. That starts after a January swearing in. Today, he'll meet with President Bush to talk transition and the many challenges the nation faces. These handover meetings usually take place later in the year, but both the 43rd and 44th president see the need to move fast. Here's the Obama transition team co-chair, Valerie Jarrett, on NBC's Meet the Press.
Given really the daunting challenges that we face, it's important that President-elect Obama is prepared to really take power and begin to rule day one.
Republicans are also looking ahead to next year. They'll have new leadership after a disappointing cycle. One of the party's rising stars is Virginia Congressman Eric Cantor, heard here on Fox.
At the end of the day, I think you will see a Republican Party in Congress serving as a check and a balance against Mr. Obama's power and Speaker Pelosi's power.
Now, they'll have to do that with fewer troops. Right now, Republicans are looking at a net loss of 19 seats in the House. Watch for that number to change, though. Four House races are still too close to call.
At least 28 are dead and dozens more wounded after a devastating double suicide bombing in Iraq. The attack on a majority Shiite neighborhood was Baghdad's deadliest in weeks. And a big story from our partners at the New York Times this morning. According to their report, the U.S. military has launched nearly a dozen secret attacks with troops on the ground inside countries including Pakistan and Syria. Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld authorized the strikes back in 2004 in an order allowing attacks on the al-Qaeda network worldwide.
Troubled insurance giant American International Group is getting another aid package from taxpayers. AIG will get $40 billion. The government will take an ownership stake. AIG has already gotten $150 billion in aid. In other money news, a big fall for gas prices.
This is the second biggest drop in the history of the gasoline market. The biggest one of all was in the prior two-week period when prices fell 53 cents in a two-week period.
That's energy analyst Trilby Lundberg.
Okay, China's going to spend a half a trillion to save the world. We're going to talk about that in a minute. And we're filling out Barack Obama's bookshelf, but his album playlist over here at The Takeaway needs some work. Can you help?
Hi, this is Jack Grace, musician and contributor for The Takeaway. If I was to pick an album for Obama to listen to right now, I would have to say Steve Earle, The Revolution Starts Now. The title says it all, and there's even a song making fun of Condoleezza Rice. How much better could you do than that?
877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Check the headlines. It's definitely stacking up to be a global summit's worth of issues facing the president-elect in the next 74 days. 74 days. Hey, how about 7 days? Today, China announced a perhaps quarter of a trillion dollar domestic stimulus package that is partly for China's consumption, but also is all about rescuing the global financial system, or at least the global economy struggling with recession. And Russia, moments after Barack Obama was elected, actually created a confrontation that the president-elect will have to deal with almost immediately on missile defenses in Europe. Joining us now to talk about both of these things, they're both worthy of a summit on their own, is Jeffrey Mankoff, who is adjunct fellow for Russian studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a postdoc associate at the International Security Studies Center at Yale University. Jeffrey, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And, of course, on the line from Shanghai is David Barboza, New York Times reporter, our partner, the New York Times. David, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
David, let's begin with the China stimulus package. I mean, this is an enormous example of China's economic clout. And I wonder how much is domestic and how much is for sort of global consumption.
Well, this is mostly the way they've announced it, for domestic consumption and to get the economy in China going. Now, hopefully that'll also have something to do with the global economy. At least they're hoping is that they'll do their part for the global economy by keeping China chugging along. And much of the growth in the global economy may be coming from China, so they need to keep it, the consumption going here and the investment going here in China's booming economy on track.
Now, in the United States, if growth, you know, is at 2-3%, we're like, you know, having parties in the streets. In China, it's a completely different calculus. If growth falls below 8%, they have serious worries about domestic tranquility. How does that work?
That's right. They've had growth accelerating up to about 12% earlier this year. And now they're back down to 9% and worried that that's going to dip down to 7 or even 6%, which they haven't had in about 7 or 8 years. And the worry in China is that the country is being transformed. And if the growth slows down dramatically, that big push of moving rural farmers into the big cities and the transformation that's been going on will somehow come unhinged, and people might start to get angry about not seeing their incomes grow and not being able to move onto better jobs.
David, this is an enormous proposal. Two questions. One, is there any sense that perhaps the Chinese economy is worse off than Chinese officials have indicated? And second of all, it certainly took a lot of analysts by surprise, this nearly $500 billion.
Yeah, I think on the first one, there have been lots of analysts looking at China from a lot of different ways, not only the government statistics, but doing their own surveys. And often some of the analysts had believed that China was downplaying how strong the growth was in the country. I think there are worries that the growth is slowing so rapidly and that consumer confidence and investor confidence is drying up pretty quickly in the last couple of months. But I don't think anyone believes that it's slowed much more than has been announced or the figures that they're seeing. So I think, you know, they believe that China is still growing, but the worry is that just that it will slow down so fast and that'll just, you know, careen toward 4 or 5%.
And indeed, David, it's hard to have a window into the Chinese economy with the yuan not being fully convertible and also the arrangements that the government has made with various kinds of industries in the country. But you make a good point, and it does appear as though this is all about domestic tranquility, at least in the short term. Jeffrey Mankoff, let's bring you into this discussion for a moment. Why is the missile defense issue the number one priority, if we're to believe Medvedev, the Russian president, in dealing with the new Barack Obama administration?
The Russians have been a little bit neuralgic about this proposed missile defense system ever since it was first put forward by President Bush several years ago. Of course, the system, according to its designers, is being put in place in order to stop the launch of ballistic missiles from rogue regimes in the Middle East, by which they mean particularly Iran. Now, it would deal only with missile with sort of intermediate range missiles, so things coming from Iran targeted at Europe. There's always been a lot of question as to whether that was a realistic scenario, both technologically and politically, because, you know, it seems that the reasons the Iranians would have for wanting to launch missiles at Europe are a little bit dubious.
But the way that's playing out, the way that's playing out this week is you've got the proposal already on the books for the U.S. deploying. Now the Russians have said, okay, we're going to put missiles in Poland or near Poland. Now the latest response from Russia is, well, hey, we won't even bother to do this if Barack Obama decides not to deploy this. What kind of a response would you have to something like this?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of this has to do with American domestic politics as well, because the Democrats have long been skeptical about the utility of stationing this missile defense platform in Poland and the Czech Republic. And I think what the Russians are trying to do is put pressure on Obama to back down from installing the system. Part of the problem, though, is that they're doing it in such an in-your-face kind of way that, you know, now President-elect Obama has been kind of backed into a corner on this. He can't be seen to be backing down in the face of Russian pressure by immediately going out and canceling the system, even though I think he and a lot of the Democratic Party have a fair degree of skepticism about both the utility and the effectiveness of the system.
Well, Jeffrey, what about just ignoring it? And that's what most of the world did when Medvedev tried to set up this so-called Asian alliance supporting their invasion of Georgia. The rest of the world just ignored it. Oil prices dropped 40%, and now, poof, nobody even remembers it.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly a possibility. I think, you know, the Eastern Europeans, the Poles in particular, are going to be pressuring the United States very strongly into following through with their commitment to station this platform in their territory, in part because they do see it as a kind of guarantee against Russian interference in their political affairs and against Russia's ability to pressure them. And so if President-elect Obama is going to pull out of the system, he's going to find himself under enormous pressure from American allies in Eastern Europe.
Well, let me bring David Barboza into this. From the Chinese perspective, where there's plenty of coverage of Russia's intention to raise its profile on the world stage, I'm wondering if there's a bit of an echo here. If China makes all of these gains economically in its dealings with the United States, does that reduce the amount of leverage for the new administration in pushing for traditional kinds of Chinese human rights reforms, and that Barack Obama is going to be sandbagged on the Chinese front as well as on the Russian front, as Jeffrey Mankoff is pointing out?
Right. I mean, certainly China's influence in the world is growing, and its economy is growing, and actually it has a stranglehold on a lot of American assets, a lot of American dollars, and so they certainly are going to have a lot more clout with the next administration than they had with the former administration, although they had a good relationship in many ways with the Bush administration. But there are still trade issues, and that could resurface under President Obama, because that's one of the things he's talked about is trade with China and whether jobs are coming to China. So there's going to be some tangling going on, but certainly if the Chinese economy is backing up strong with this stimulus package and the U.S. economy is weak, China's influence is going to rise that much faster.
Do you see any sort of China-Russia conflict on an issue on the defense sphere like this missile defense issue going on now between the Russians and the Americans on the European frontier?
I don't. I haven't heard anything about that, and I think that's unlikely.
All right. Finally, Jeffrey, there's some talk that Putin might actually reassert himself into the prime ministership. Any suggestion that that would be something that would take place in the early months of the Obama administration?
Into the presidency, I think.
He's going to come back. Medvedev is going to back out. How would that work?
Well,
It's kind of a rumor.
Yeah. I mean, Medvedev spoke during his State of the Nation address the day after President-elect Obama was elected in this country, suggesting that one of the things that the Russian Duma, that is the parliament, should consider is extending the presidential term from 4 years to six. And it was widely reported in the Russian press at the time that this was a prelude to President Medvedev stepping down,
right,
and Prime Minister Putin
tantalizing back. When that's reported in Russia. Jeffrey Mankoff, thanks so much for being with us, talking about the early days of Russia versus the U.S. and David Barboza, the Chinese stimulus package, talking to us from Shanghai. Thank you, David.
You're welcome.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Put a page in America's briefing book for Barack Obama to read or watch or to put on his to-do list before he becomes president.
Hi, this is Matt from Brooklyn, New York. I think Barack Obama should watch Who Killed the Electric Car? It's a great film about electric cars and how they were killed by a number of factors, including the auto industry, oil industry, and consumers themselves. And given this bailout of the auto industry, I think he could put some strings attached with that money he's given to the auto industry.
What should be in America's briefing book for the new president, Barack Obama? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now, Adora, this next story is about Main Street. Okay, I know you're not going to think so, but it is actually about Main Street, not Wall Street, and certainly not
also
the Strip in Las Vegas.
Right, thriving universe.
Well, casinos businesses are down. I mean, the casinos around the country are doing really, really, you know, they're having a lot of economic trouble in the midst of all of this economic downturn and fears of recession. But you wouldn't know it by looking at the World Series of Poker. It's a changed game. It's a gigantic media event. This year, the World Series of Poker has whittled down the competition from 6,000 entrants to 9 competitors who are going to be playing for $32 million. That's the jackpot, and it's going to be live on TV. Gary Belsky, editor-in-chief of ESPN the magazine, joins The Takeaway on Monday morning to talk about the sports stories of the weekend, including, right at the top, the World Series of Poker. How significant is this, and what in business terms is going on? Because poker rooms around the country aren't doing as well as the World Series is doing.
Yeah, a lot of casinos have closed their poker rooms, replaced them with slot machines. In general, I think the World Series of Poker stands out as something separate from the general gaming trends. This year, the total pot for the World Series of Poker is about $180 million.
That's
up from about
$180 million?
Yes.
And no recession there.
No recession there, and it's up from about $160 million last year. But by total pot, I mean for the entire World Series of Poker. What people get confused about is that it's actually a 47-day event with 55 different games being played. And the thing that gets the most attention is the main event, which is the one that has 6,000 players. And that's down from the peak of a couple years ago. So people were thinking that the World Series was on the wane. It probably is a little bit down, but nonetheless, as you can see, the overall pot is higher. And by the way, it won't be live because you can't actually broadcast live poker. You can't broadcast live gambling according to Nevada law.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the November 9 actually played down to 2 yesterday. There's now only 2 guys remaining, and what's going to happen is ESPN, a brand with which I am enormously involved with, is going to broadcast an edited version of the final table tomorrow. The last 2 guys play today, actually, and then we will have a winner, and they'll do the whole thing tomorrow on TV.
TV and technology have really changed the whole poker game completely. I mean, the experience of watching the game of poker on television is like nothing you'd ever find at the casino. Explain.
Exactly. Well, for the World Series of Poker has been going on for about 30 years, and for the most part, nobody paid attention aside from Gabe Kaplan and a whole bunch of really beat card players. And then about 8 or 9 years ago, somebody invented technology that allowed you to watch the game as it unfolded, meaning you could see everybody's cards as they got them. And that actually made it interesting to watch because you could understand the betting based on what people were doing. And that changed everything. ESPN got involved in a much more serious way. And all of a sudden, it went from being just this tiny, bizarre little world of gamblers to a giant mainstream event. And the big thing about the World Series of Poker, for people who don't quite know what it's about, is that it's as if the U.S. Open in tennis or golf allowed you to buy your way in. So therefore, anybody who is a poker player can actually play in what was or still is the biggest tournament in the world.
I mean, it's so a little like American Idol.
Yeah, well, except for you have to pony up. And how much is that to pony up to get in?
To get into the main event, it costs $10,000. And what a lot of people do is they play in, like, I play in a regular Wednesday night poker game. And a lot of times people will either play online or they will play in their regular games and they will sort of play in what are called satellite tournaments in order to win the money to play, to get the $10,000 to play in the big event. But there's also a lot of people who are just rich and want to play. There are a lot of celebrities, Ray Romano, Jennifer Tilly. She's actually become quite a good poker player. So there's a lot of different ways that people get in, everybody has to put up 10 grand and then everybody gets a seat. You can be
Everybody doesn't get a seat. I'm totally jaded. Look, they cast this, okay, right? There's always like the Asian guy, there's the guy with the eye patch and the cowboy hat, then there's like the young sort of internet dude who's sort of there with his like reverse baseball cap and
1,900 of those guys.
In each category, right?
Exactly. And the final two guys, by the way, are down to, there's a guy named Peter Eastgate, whom if he wins would be the youngest to ever win. He's 22. And there's a guy from Russia named Ivan Demenidov, and he is a professional poker player. Those are the final two guys. But the tournament will be broadcast tomorrow night. All of this stuff, by the way, is available on the web. You can see who won. So far.
One other little sports story before we go. The NCAA basketball tournament is going to, or basketball rules, they want to widen the three-point shot line. Why, and what's the resistance to doing that?
Well, in general, they're trying in basketball is attempting to make the game uniform throughout the world, both between the NBA and international games and Olympics and college basketball. And so college basketball forever, for the last 20 years, has allowed the big shot, meaning the three-point shot, right, as opposed to the two-point shot, to go from 19 feet 9 inches. And now they are expanding it to 20 feet 9 inches. And they think nobody knows what the effect is going to be. It could either make the game more exciting or make the game
or less.
More boring. Yeah, unintended consequences. But I think it's going to be a good thing, because imagine if a tennis court had different sort of lines in different countries or in different leagues. The tennis court is uniform, so should the basketball court be uniform.
Well, Gary Belsky, thanks so much for explaining all that important stuff to us, including the World Series of Poker. Gary Belsky is editor-in-chief of ESPN, the magazine. Thanks for coming to the studio, as always.
My pleasure.
Phillips turns over a royal flush.
Royal flush.
Mabuchi, quad aces.
You got to be kidding me. Quad aces, your last hand of the main event.
It's time to play our ace. Femi Okay with the headlines.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. Stock markets across Asia rose sharply today following China's announcement yesterday of a large economic stimulus plan. The country promised $586 billion to encourage economic growth. That trend may continue on Wall Street. Dow Industrial Futures are up around about 2%. Barack Obama has visited the White House before, but not the Oval Office. He'll go there for the first time today for a private meeting with President Bush. The historic occurrence is happening earlier than usual this year because of the troubled economy. And while Barack Obama says he's approaching today's meeting with a spirit of bipartisanship, he isn't afraid to change some of the president's policies. According to John Podesta, top member of his transition team, the president-elect plans to reverse decisions that restrict stem cell research and allow oil drilling in the wilderness. The feud between Zimbabwean leaders continues. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai has refused a request from Southern African leaders to begin governing with President Mugabe. He says they need to settle a dispute over control of cabinet positions first. And a sad day for South Africans and lovers of Mama Africa. Miriam Makeba has died at the age of 76. She suffered a heart attack after performing a concert in Italy. That was early this morning. That's Look Your News for now.
She's a brilliant performer. Brilliant. Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Put a page in Barack Obama's briefing book, America's briefing book for the new president. Book recommendations and anything else at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hi, this is Gail DeLong from Morristown, New Jersey. I think President-elect Obama should read Healing the New Childhood Epidemics, Autism, ADHD, Asthma, and Allergies.
Give us your suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
John, we're going to turn to a discussion about global food and the crisis that we saw burgeoning early this year. The worldwide economic collapse, though, has temporarily brought down food prices and turned attention away from that crisis that we saw, where we saw deadly food riots threatening dozens of countries. Economist Paul Collier, who's a professor and director of the Center for the Study of African Economies at Oxford University, and the author of The Bottom Billion, The Poorest Countries Are Failing and What Can Be Done About It, he joins us to add a few pages to The Takeaway's briefing book for President-elect Barack Obama. Thanks for being with us, Paul.
Thanks for inviting me on.
So food prices are down. That's good. But you're warning that world powers need to stay vigilant. Explain.
I think the big reason for the increase in food prices, which was huge, was the growth of Asia. Asia's eating more and it's eating better. And that's going to continue. Similarly, America cut its supply of food by moving into ethanol in a big way. And if that continues, we'll have reduced supply and higher demand and so higher prices. And that's a disaster for the poorest people in the world.
So there are three things that you would advise an Obama administration to consider. Do you want to lay those out for us?
Yes, I think the most important one for America is the ethanol scam. Your agriculture lobby has been very effective over the years in finding subsidies, and ethanol was the new subsidy game. That took pretty well a third of your grain supply out of the food market, and that was a big hit. Europe's got its own equivalent scam, which was the ban on GM, on genetically modified crops. That's reduced European food supply. It shot Europe in the foot, but it also was imitated by African governments. Practically every African government banned GM because they thought if Europe had banned them, then GM probably wasn't safe. We know scientifically that's wrong. There's no scientific basis for the ban on GM. It was just a piece of protectionism. So what I'd like to see is America end the biofuel scam and Europe end the GM ban.
And does that go specifically then to the distribution problems? We've spoken to many experts on this show who say, look, there really is enough food on the planet. It's a question of getting the food to the people who need it.
Well, food's distributed through markets, and markets respond to prices. What happened was that because world demand went up, world supply got hit, prices exploded. They may well explode again. I think that's quite likely. And the people who get hit hardest are the people living in the big coastal cities of the poorest cities in the world, because those coastal cities are basically fed at world prices. So if world prices explode, the people in those cities get hit. And if you're poor in those cities, then typically about half of your overall budget is going on food. So if food prices explode, you get hit.
I read that world food prices have jumped 83% since 2005, and this has been not impacted by the dropping of prices that we've seen over the last couple of months compared to earlier in the year.
That's right. And so for a poor household, just think what an 83% increase in food prices means. That's half your budget. You're already desperately poor, and half your budget has nearly doubled in cost. I fear that the people really at the end of the food chain, at the bottom, right at the back of the food chain, are the children of the urban poor. And we now know from nutrition studies that if they stay malnourished for more than a couple of years, they get stunting, which is a permanent condition. It's irreversible. And it's not just physical, it's mental. So if food prices stay high for a couple of years, we've created a generation that are both physically and mentally damaged.
But, Paul, given the economic crisis, the international economic crisis, where do you think the political will is to take on some of these policies that both the Europe and the United States have relied on and are not necessarily likely to change amid all of the other crises they're facing?
I think the crisis can work for us because the ethanol scam and the GM ban are both, they're costing America and Europe money. They're very foolish expenditures. And so in an environment where we've got to get smarter with our money, the easiest thing to do politically is to face down these greedy lobbies. And that's true both in America and in Europe. And so the impetus to face down the lobbies should be stronger than ever. And of course, there's a rare moment that now President Obama has been elected. There's an enormous amount of goodwill in Europe mm-hmm. towards him, and a great sense that Europe ought to deliver on what he asks.
Okay.
And so if he asks for getting rid of that GM ban, he'll get it.
Thank you very much. I think a takeaway there might be to face down those greedy lobbyists. Thank you, Paul Collier.
Thanks very much indeed.
Paul Collier is a professor of economics and director of the Center for the Study of African Economies at Oxford University and the author of The Bottom Billion, Why the Poorest Countries Are Failing. Now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got some headlines for us.
Thank you. The time is just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Police report that at least 28 people are dead and dozens more injured after three bombs went off this morning in northern Baghdad. As people hurried to help victims of a car bombing, a suicide bomber ran into the crowd and blew himself up. According to a report by the New York Times, the US military has carried out almost a dozen secret attacks against Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, Syria, and elsewhere in the world. They were authorized in 2004 by secret order allowing the military to attack Al-Qaeda in countries anywhere in the world. The Defense Department has not confirmed the report. Meanwhile, the Pakistani president says that US airstrikes have hindered his country's fight against militants near the Afghan border. He hopes that Barack Obama will take a new look at Pakistan's objections. Cholera is beginning to spread among refugees in eastern Congo. 45 cases have been reported in the region since Friday. Near a quarter of a million people were displaced in fighting between rebel forces and government troops. And the UN reports that new fighting has erupted in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. A 6.5 earthquake struck in northwestern China earlier today. No deaths have been reported so far in the remote region. Western China is prone to earthquakes. A 7.9 tremor that hit there last May left 5 million people homeless. And that's a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. South African leaders have announced they will send peacekeepers to help secure the Democratic Republic of Congo, where violence has erupted. The decision came after a summit in Johannesburg. Meanwhile, the international aid agency, Doctors Without Borders, has warned that an outbreak of cholera is posing a new threat to tens of thousands of people displaced by the fighting. We're joined on the line from Goma in eastern Congo by BBC reporter Mark Lowen. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
What's the plan and how soon do you expect it to be executed?
Well, there are lots of conflicting plans, really. On a humanitarian level, the plan is to try and bring as much aid and as much basic equipment into Congo to try and deal with the, frankly, dire humanitarian situation. There are now estimated to be about 100,000 people who have fled their homes and villages in the last few days. And this is a province now, North Kivu, where, from where I'm talking to you now, Goma, capital of North Kivu. North Kivu, in this province alone, it's estimated that around 1 million people have now been left homeless because of the fighting. That is a fifth of the population. So obviously there is a need for a plan of some sort to send in some humanitarian aid, which is slowly coming in, and also some sort of diplomatic sort of observers. When in Nairobi, I was in Nairobi a few days ago before coming here, and at the summit there of African Union leaders, the plan was to dispatch a sort of Great Lakes region, Central African region observer mission. I'm sorry, there's a helicopter coming over the top here. I hope you can still hear me.
We can hear you.
As I gather, the summit in South Africa has decided that there will again be an observer mission that will come here to try and enforce peace in Eastern Congo and try to bring to an end this awful conflict and this awful humanitarian situation.
Describe how the rebels have triggered this latest round of violence, what their strategy is, and how far have they moved towards challenging the government?
Well, the front, there are several front lines now in this war, one of which is to the north of Goma. It's about 10 kilometers north of Goma. That is where the rebel front line is at the moment. And there is another front line to the west of Goma, some 40 to 50 kilometers west, and that is where some of the fighting broke out yesterday in a town called Ngungu, which was a town that really hadn't seen much fighting up until that point. So it was seen as particularly worrying that there was this outbreak of fighting there. Now, the fighting is principally between pro-government militias, notably the Mai Mai, and which are effectively Hutu, ethnic Hutu militias that support the Congolese government, and also between them and ethnic Tutsi militias, the largest of which is called the CNDP, which is under the auspices of renegade General Laurent Nkunda. And they are believed to be, or at least believed by Congo, to be supported and aided by the ethnic Tutsi government in Rwanda. So there is this sort of tension, a very volatile situation, and tension between these militias that has caused the conflict up until now. Now, I have to say that although there has been...
Mark, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you. Mark Lowen giving us an update of what's happening in Goma, Congo. BBC correspondent who is reporting to us from Goma.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, November 10th. Femi OK has the latest headlines.
Good morning. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Today is President-elect Barack Obama's first visit to the White House since winning a place there. He'll meet with President Bush to talk about the transition into his administration. Both sides agreed to hold the meeting earlier than usual, owing mostly to the economic crisis. Troubled insurance giant American International Group is getting another aid package from taxpayers. AIG will get $40 billion. The government takes an ownership stake in the deal. AIG has already gotten $150 billion in aid. China is pumping big bucks into their economy as well, more than half $1 trillion. It's a mix of tax breaks and spending on education and the environment. Asian markets soared after the move. European markets are also doing well at this hour. Zimbabwe's opposition party leader is rejecting a compromise deal on power sharing. Morgan Tsvangirai says that since the ruling party controls the army, the opposition party should control the police. And finally, there's a lot of love around for President-elect Barack Obama. Babies in the US are being named after him and his family. There's a glut of baby Baracks in Kenya, and even a baby girl called Baraka. And Barack Obama's father was Kenyan, so you expect all of that hoo-ha. And his great-grandfather on his mother's side can be traced back to Ireland, a fact that's being celebrated right now.
O'Leary, O'Reilly, O'Hara, O'Hara, there's no one as Irish as Barack Obama.
Well, there you go, don't you? Yes. Yes, indeed, Femi.
Cracks me up. Of course, the OKs are from County Kerry, so I can completely identify with that story.
That's priceless. And as a citizen of Ireland that I am very proud of my fellow Irishmen and women.
It's a beautiful song. It will crack you up, make you cry. It's on YouTube. There's no one as Irish as Barack Obama. Several versions, even a great rock version as well.
Oh, you know, Femi, Adora didn't much like Barack Obama until she found out he
was Irish.
Yeah, right.
Then it all changed.
Yeah, then it all changed. Yes. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So in the wake of the Barack Obama victory and the potential party and political realignment that it represents, it's worthwhile to go back way before Karl Rove, way before George W. Bush, to the man who potentially started the tactics of divide and conquer in Washington and around the United States, to the land and the time of Lee Atwater. And joining us is the filmmaker, Emmy and Peabody Award-winning filmmaker Stefan Forbes, whose latest film is called Boogeyman, The Lee Atwater Story, and it airs tomorrow night on your local PBS station on Frontline. Stefan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
We're going to play a little bit of Lee Atwater and get a feel for his particular style. Boogeyman is actually a double entendre there because he's a rock and roller. Lee Atwater is. He's not a scary guy. I mean, he is a scary guy to Democrats who had to face him, but he was also, a musician.
Right. And it's even a triple entendre, I would venture to say, because he learned about our fears and he learned how to reach to the heart of our deepest fears about race and crime and things like that by using this guy Willie Horton as a boogeyman, and then the Democrats began using Atwater as a boogeyman. So there's all kinds of boogeymen in this story.
Now, let's put the resume up for people to think about here. You mentioned the Willie Horton ad, which brought down Dukakis.
Sure.
Right, in 1988.
Or prevented him from getting up.
Right, prevented him from getting up. What other memorable political tactics was Lee Atwater responsible for?
Well, it was actually a lot of fun making the movie and uncovering some of these things. I mean, in 72, Karl Rove was running for chairman of the College Republicans. You know, completely unknown guy. Atwater was his campaign manager, and they lose. Atwater just says, no, I'm not going to accept defeat. They start throwing out ballots of the opposition. The whole thing gets kicked upstairs to the head of the Republican Party, who's a kind of obscure functionary named George H.W. Bush. And the three of these guys have this mind meld. Bush gives the election to Rove and Atwater. And Atwater has really taught Rove a lesson he learned, you know, years later in 2000 in Florida. You know, it's never over. Just take the election, claim the victory.
And something in the year 2000 that, maybe is an echo to that old college Republican battle that George H.W. Bush acted as the Supreme Court of and basically called the election. Let's talk about the style of Lee Atwater. Here was somebody who loved the press, who loved politics, and was an absolute charmer. Kind of a devilish combination, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and he kind of masqueraded as this country rube, you know, guitar-picking rascal from South Carolina. He'd actually gone back to grad school to get a degree in communications, and he knew the weak points of the press.
Well, listen to Lee Atwater in action here, talking about Michael Dukakis and then Michael Dukakis' reaction as it appears in your film.
And what does Dukakis do? Every time he stands up, he attacks George Bush. He's a hypocrite. We all know that. You know it, too. That is reflective of the kind of out-of-touch crowd they are. They probably sat up in Brookline eating Belgium endives and a quiche out of the can and figured, well, what...
Well, obviously, he and the folks around Bush were trying to make me a kind of Northeast liberal who was out of touch and that kind of thing. I mean, the irony of this is that, you know, I'm the guy who was the son of Greek immigrants who came over here and lived the American dream. Nothing against Yankee Brahmins who were here since 1630.
I mean, here's the story of Lee Atwater, who's Strom Thurmond's protege in the Senate in South Carolina, taking on this style where he plants this innuendo and plants these sort of boogeyman ideas that take down people, even if it's completely at odds with who they actually are. What are some other examples?
Well, in that same race, I mean, he worked really hard to plant this smear that Dukakis suffered from mental illness. And I talked to Bob Novak about it in the movie, and he says, you know, Atwater had this crazy idea that I would print things that weren't double-sourced, you know, which always gets a laugh. But, you know, Novak didn't print it. Then they had a reporter actually plant the question in a White House press conference, and Ronald Reagan said, hey, I'm not going to pick on an invalid. I mean, the president of the United States called the Democratic nominee insane. It hit front pages all around the country, and it was a kind of politics of innuendo and smear that Atwater actually taught his party. This is the way you win.
And it makes me think of what Jon Stewart now calls this post-factual world that we live in, and it seems like Atwater was certainly at the front of helping to create that world where you say something enough, it becomes true even when the facts belie it.
One of Lee's confidants, Tucker Eskew, who he trained and went on to be a senior advisor to McCain, said Lee was the first person he ever heard say, perception is reality. You know, just say it so. And it's this new kind of Southern evangelical Christian faith-based politics where he taught the GOP to just say whatever they wanted and make it so.
You know, the interesting thing about that, though, is that, and if you see this film, it's fantastic, it's a WGBH production, Frontline. You know, Karl Rove had to say it a lot for it to be true. Atwater only had to say it a couple times, and his fingerprints were never on the backstabbing tactic. That's the other thing about him.
Yeah, and he, you know, he had a favorite saying, wrestling is the only honest sport in town, because it's so obviously phony. It didn't even try to be like a real sport, and that's how he saw politics. And Atwater was seen as this cool guy by this whole generation of Washington reporters and a young generation of political operatives.
Untimely end in a very tragic way.
Yeah,
as
yeah.
Well.
But not before he infected them with that politics as wrestling view of the world.
Hmm. So is there a lesson? What do you think Lee Atwater would say about what happened last Tuesday?
Well, they ran his playbook, which has been winning elections long after his death, almost every time. They ran it in such a ham-fisted way. And I really don't think they understood, you know, the horror and revulsion of most Americans at overtly racist rhetoric coming out. You know, their campaigns turned into kind of hate rallies. And they just released the news that as Sarah Palin's rhetoric got worse, the threat level against Barack Obama went higher and higher. People are really out there trying to kill him because of this kind of rhetoric. So
the play they forgot was, if you're going to do it, you have to be subtle. You
exactly.
have to be charming, and you maybe have to play the guitar. Stefan Forbes, thank you very much.
Good pleasure.
Stefan Forbes' film, The Boogeyman, all about Lee Atwater, is on tomorrow night on PBS. It's a Frontline WGBH production. WGBH, of course, our partner. Thanks so much for coming in, Stefan.
And here at The Takeaway, we're still putting together our briefing book for President-elect Barack Obama. Gary tells us on our website, the linchpin of our Mideast policy needs to be the unsolved Palestinian issue. Without the view that the U.S. is honestly brokering peace, we will never solve the larger issues facing us throughout the Muslim world. I suggest to Barack Obama that he read Jimmy Carter's book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Give us your thoughts.
877-8-MY-TAKE. Here's your takeaway.
If food prices stay high for a couple of years, we've created a generation that are both physically and mentally damaged.
That's Paul Collier, director of the Center for the Study of African Economies at Oxford University. We're always on at The Takeaway, and you can check out our podcast on iTunes if you missed anything.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.